Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. In Ukraine, today is a day of celebration and sadness. On this day, 31 years ago, Ukraine declared independence from the Soviet Union after nearly 70 years under Moscow's control. This came as the USSR was slowly crumbling, and many Soviet satellite states had already established democracies after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. Ukraine's Independence Day is typically marked with a military parade in the capital, Air Force pilots flying over the Independence Square in Kyiv, and people gathering in their local town squares to celebrate. That was what some of the celebrations sounded like in Kyiv 1 year ago. But when Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th of this year, that changed. Today also marks 6 months since the start of Russia's war on Ukraine. And in the capital today, Kyiv authorities have banned mass gatherings for fear of intensified attacks from Russia. Destroyed and burned out Russian tanks and military equipment lined the capital's main street. A quiet, triumphant nod to Russia's president, who had once hoped to overtake the city. And across the U.S., vigils and events were held throughout the week in solidarity with Ukraine. Last night, a crowd gathered at a park in Lower Manhattan in a candlelight vigil organized by Razum, a nonprofit in New York working to support Ukraine. Attendees wore Ukrainian flags and held candles to honor the soldiers and civilians whose lives have been lost in the war. Joining me now is Natalia Homanyuk, a Ukrainian journalist and founder of the Public Interest Journalism Lab. She's got some updates from Kyiv. Thanks for joining us, Natalia.
Good to talk to you.
Now, I want to note for our listeners that as I spoke with Natalia, it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon in Ukraine. Can you tell us what Ukrainian Independence Day celebrations typically look like?
So it's still, even today, more a day of joy, a very emotional day, and very positive and bright. So really, usually, and more with the years, people were coming to the central streets. The most important was, of course, in Kyiv, in the Independence Square, which a remarkable place also to the Ukrainian history, because there was a students' protest still during the Soviet Union at that streets. There was the Orange Revolution, the Euromaidan Revolution. So it's really like the Independence Square. They were the place of gathering. And in other towns, maybe in the major cities, there would be also the similar events. And people usually do this in the morning. They come with a family, with kids. It won't be really like the very military day, rather than, you know, people would gather the nation, would wear the embroidered shirt in Ukrainian, you know, traditional outfits, and there would be a lot of kids. So it would be a very calm, relaxed day off. Of course, not really today, though it's still a very bright, more bright and joyful, you know, day rather than the day of sorrow.
So still joyful, still a sense of empowerment, but it's kind of early in the afternoon for you there. I don't hear you saying somber, but maybe just sort of less celebratory, sort of fewer people.
So
help us understand.
It's totally different because, of course, you know, the Russian tactics, especially during the last months, changed a lot. They don't really fully, you know, fight when military fights the military. The Russian strategy is about the random attack on the peaceful towns all over the country. And of course, there are the growing concern, and there is an anxiety that, you know, because it's very symbolic, it's exactly what Russia is fighting, the Ukrainian independence, the Ukrainians who are celebrating their independence, that any peaceful gathering would be a major risk. So, of course, there was no even the discussion that would be anything like a military parade. First of all, because the equipment should be on the front line, but also people are not advised to be on the streets. So I wonder if you heard this sound. I have the air sirens alarm on my mobile, as every citizen in Ukraine. So for instance, we have the constant air sirens warning. I think like the first was something at 6 a.m., but maybe later. Since the morning, it's all over the country. So basically, people getting more used to, you know, getting to the basement and finding their place, I don't know, at least in the corridor or elsewhere. But today, we do feel that something might happen. So there is this anxiety. So people, you know, they congratulate themselves on Facebook, over the media. They still, you know, celebrate, speak about the last 30 years, think about the military. But let's say from home, like imagine like the very strict COVID, for instance, you know, when you still can do the things, but you cannot really be outside. At least you're not advised.
It's a very useful analogy there that in those early days of COVID, right, there were, you tried to create some kinds of solidarity, but not physically together, not outside, but such a different kind of danger in this case. What does this 6-month mark symbolize?
Interesting. I've just read the very interesting sociological survey by the Ukrainian company Rating, and they were asking people, what do they feel first of all? And like 70% of the Ukrainians feel about the country exactly prior to the Independence Day. They were speaking about the pride for their country. And, you know, more or less half and half people feel some sadness, but also joy, because there is generally considered that exactly that's the Russia wanted to, you know, conquer Ukraine, to occupy it, not to make it independent. So being firm and determined, despite of all the exhaustion and despite all the losses, is already victory. It's the tremendous price had been paid. But also what's something I find very interesting in this survey as well, there were a lot of questions. And when the people wanted to have some association about Ukraine, they usually speaking about and the Ukraine future, they were speaking about freedom, independence, and maybe kind of developed European type country. And there was 0 point for people who are indifferent to their future of the country. You know, I mean, and that's really sociological, like zero, like nobody is indifferent to the future of the country, which, you know, of course, is the sign of kind of a crisis moment, but still, I find it remarkable.
Natalia, your point that this survey is showing a universal sense of attachment to the future. Talk to me about what folks are hearing, what you're hearing about what Russia is saying about the future. What has their response been? Has there been a particular kind of escalation in this moment?
So I didn't like it. There are two things to say. The first, I think it's very important historically. You know, I myself and my organization for the last years, we were, especially last year when there was the 30th anniversary of independence, we were doing the documentary series on the first years of independence and social surveys, all kind of the things. And what we understand that the 90s were very difficult for the Ukrainians, the whole collapse of the Soviet Union, the economic crisis, the incredible transformation and change. It was very traumatic, but somehow when we talked to the people, we felt that people feel that they overcome this trauma. They feel that this difficult experience made them stronger, and they were thinking all the time about a different country in the future. And when we really look at modern Russia, we really think that, you know, everything looks like the government wants to, you know, bring back the Soviet Union. You know, this trauma of the collapse of the Soviet Union, including, as you know, like the loss of the empire, was not really, you know, the country and the society didn't go through that. So it's really like the whole Russian narrative is about the past. It's about some glorious past in a very, this kind of banal, old-fashioned imperial way. And I do think that this change, this difference between the vision of the future and the country which leaning forward, you know, and is not afraid of its future, compared to the society which wants to go back, which is a clear revanchism, is the major difference. And on short term, it's the start of the season. Autumn is coming, the winter is coming, and people do understand that the next 3 months might be decisive, because the important battles can take place just during the because of the climate, severe winter in Ukraine. They can't take place just during the autumn, so that would be decisive. But still today, it feels like a bit decisive day. It's really, people want to understand what would happen. Would there be major airstrikes? You know, if they won't happen, would it be because the Ukrainian air defense worked? So yes, it is an important moment. And then next days would be still quite, disturbing for many.
You wrote recently in a piece for The Guardian that you have two friends who are prisoners of war under Russian forces. I'm wondering, on this day, if you have particular concern for them.
I do have particular concern. We have, at this point, 8 southern Ukrainians prisoners of war in Russia. And there is no real access to them. Mainly, you know, there is people who are live peaceful life might not know that there is Geneva Convention. There are some rules that there should be access for those people, the doctors, maybe some, I don't know, Red Cross, wherever. We don't have, you know, anything like that. We have earlier the confirmed cases of the severe tortures. We had the cases where at least 50 soldiers who needed to leave Azov Steel from Mariupol were murdered during the captivity, which is the war crime. But, you know, it's a vulnerability. So wherever I think what could be, you know, something that Russia can do, of course, we are absolutely afraid about these people. And we do understand that it's impossible to just bring them back. But, you know, at least to, you know, argue that there should be some access for the humanitarians, that would be very, very critical. And something interesting I want to add, I mentioned those two friends of mine, also very, that's for me very symbolic, that both of them were the people who till the very, very last moment were participating in all kind of the peaceful negotiations. They were like pacifist, anti-fascist, you know, like really the people who would be the last. And that was their very, very conscious choice, that there is no any other way. They had both journalistic background and then human rights background, that there was no other way than physically defend their country and to do that, which for me is again a showcase also for, you know, in the people whom I trusted a lot and respect a lot, that if they made the decision, it really shows that there was no any other way, and there is no any other way for Ukrainians to defend themselves, even if with arms, if it's needed.
Obviously, many here in the U.S. have closely followed what's happening in Ukraine. There is a emotional outpouring. There's also an outpouring of global resources. There's been some concern that the global outpouring of resources to Ukraine to address this horrifying crisis has left much of the rest of the globe without sufficient resources. How do you respond to the concerns about trying to think about how, again, NGOs, media organizations should be balancing and understanding the Ukrainian crisis in connection with the rest of the world?
So, first of all, Ukrainians really, truly appreciate the international support and solidarity. And when there would be ever the discussion, you know, about this, I call it the competition for solidarity, and there would be some call like, oh, why it's so good to the Ukrainians? Is it like because it's European? I do think it's a bit different. It's mainly because it turned to be the democratic state with a very strong society, with a very vocal government and very functioning state, which actually does a lot all the time in order to rally for this support. So Ukrainians compared to, I don't know, Syrians or any other nation who don't have the state behind that, you know, like the democratic functioning state behind them, is actually doing this. We shouldn't take it for granted. It's not just because, you know, there is a compassion to Ukraine, but because Ukrainians really demand and work and fight for that. And I do think that there are way more resources. It's not that much. You know, technically, Ukraine received the American help with, for instance, this HIMARS, some kind of very, very precise weapon. And it really saves a lot of lives. And we're speaking about a dozen of them, really. We're speaking about a dozen of particularly military vehicles, which managed to help Ukraine to live for, let's say, another month without a very severe air raids, because Ukraine has destroyed some military weapon and military warehouses of Russia. So really, it's not that much which is needed. But I also understand that the dependence on the international support, it's Ukraine's vulnerability and the Russia itself trying to stop this help. So we should be very cautious about that. But in all the rest, I do understand. You know, I was just recently driving through the near Odessa, where is a famous port which is not working, and seen these huge, huge lines of the trucks which were trying to deliver the harvest internationally. There is very little capacity without the port. But honestly, I think the world is rich enough and big enough not to let the African countries to feel hunger, you know. It can't be just dependent on Ukraine. Then there should be other countries to come and help. But unless we sort out the whole story with the Kremlin, unless, you know, they really stop to attack the sovereign country, we cannot bring back the balance of the international security order. That's the most important.
Natalia Homenyuk is a Ukrainian journalist based in Kyiv and founder of the Public Interest Journalism Lab. Thank you so much for joining us today. And our hearts are, of course, with you and with your colleagues who are still prisoners of war.
Thank you.